The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's edition is dated October 27, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. And Time is in large block capital lettering in white, superimposed upon a pale blue background. The cover photograph is of a man standing near a body of water. He's dressed in blues, a light blue short-sleeved shirt and darker blue jeans. The water behind him looks ripply, as if it were a large body of water. It's blue-green, and of course behind that and above it is the pale icy blue behind the Time Magazine title. The individual photographed in the image on the cover is Eli Sharabi. Beginning with the view essay, Nation is the heading. We Need Uncontrolled Laughter by Liz, with two Z's, Winstead, who is a comedian, co-creator of The Daily Show, and the founder of Abortion Access Front. Authoritarians historically come for the comics first. In Vladimir Putin's Russia, satirist Idrak Mirzalizadeh was jailed and expelled for mocking Russian housing. In Egypt, Bassem Youssef, dubbed the Jon Stewart of the Arab world, was forced off the air and into exile after satirizing the country's leadership. Authoritarians are attacking these folks first because laughter is power. The reason you see so many comedians banding together right now is we understand that none of us are safe, even those who have an act that is not political. When Stephen Colbert was targeted earlier this year, I warned this was not a one-off. Then they came for Jimmy Kimmel. There is no predicting what joke might set off this particular malignant narcissist-in-chief. So really, who is to say who is next? The answer is all of us, any of us. A week after ABC pulled Jimmy Kimmel Live off the air for its host saying the MAGA gang was desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and trying to score political points from it, the network brought the show back, following significant blowback from fans. A win, sure, but also a cautionary tale. Kimmel's suspension was not a response to an audience backlash to the comments. Advertisers were not threatening to bolt, and I highly doubt ABC was caught off guard. I know firsthand how network lawyers comb through every word of a script several times before it airs. If they objected, it never would have made it to your TV. This happened because President Donald Trump is attempting to silence his critics, especially influential critics with big platforms, even if it wielding the power to do so violates the Constitution, according to legal scholars. Kimmel's reinstatement does not change the fact that the government interference was real, and the network caved, albeit temporarily, when it was threatened. The crackdown is part of a broader scheme. Over the past several decades, corporate media companies have gobbled up smaller media companies so they can control the information landscape and thus all the profits. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, has to approve many of those mergers, and Trump stacked the FCC with his supporters. Cue Trump's FCC chair, Brendan Carr, who publicly threatened Disney with consequences if it did not take action against Kimmel. "We can do this the easy way or the hard way," said Carr of Disney. "These companies can find ways to change conduct, to take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or, you know, there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead." This is not cancel culture. It is state censorship. As the story unfolded, comic after comic offered support for Jimmy. But there was an eerie silence from the self-proclaimed free speech warriors like Dave Chappelle and Andrew Schultz. It took Joe Rogan nearly a week to address it. These guys will talk for hours about how woke mobs are destroying comedy by policing speech. But when the actual president of the United States and the FCC strong-arm a network over a late-night monologue, suddenly it's crickets. Free speech, it seems, matters only when you're punching down. I have known Jimmy a long time. I was a producer on the pilot of The Man Show in 1999. Yes, me, the loud-ass feminist. I've never been shocked when I did not get booked at a club or was canceled from gigs because of what I dared mention on stage. Abortion, homophobia, sexism, racism, fascism, really any of the isms or the phobias. As frustrating and sometimes maddening as it is, I know the difference between clubs not booking me or audiences deciding they do not like my material and the government blocking my right to tell those jokes. A parent company like Disney's investment in free speech has one driving economic principle. Does it make us money? When I perform as a comedian, I speak full-throatedly about abortion, and audiences can boo, boycott, or bail. That's the free market of ideas. I cultivate my own audience, and I book theaters that align with my values. If after all that I still cannot fill a room or get heckled, I live with the results. But here is the crucial line. When the government threatens media outlets with regulatory punishment unless they silence dissent, that is not the marketplace. That is authoritarianism. And Carr's hypocrisy makes it even more galling. In 2018, during an FCC oversight hearing, Carr told Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, "The whole purpose of the First Amendment is to encourage strong, robust, perhaps rough, in some situations, discourse. My job is to act consistent with the First Amendment in every single thing I do." Fast forward to today, and he's using his position to muzzle a comedian. So which is it, Brendan? Jimmy's quick return is not proof of corporate backbone. What it does reiterate is the vulnerability of our freedoms. Disney blinked once and could just as easily blink again. Late-night stars are getting the attention and the headlines, but it does not stop there. Vice President J.D. Vance has literally urged Americans to report neighbors and colleagues who criticized Kirk, even if those criticisms were just Kirk's own words repeated back. "Call them out, and hell, call their employer," said Vance, conflating criticizing Kirk with celebrating his death. That's making McCarthyism great again. You would not know it by the way this administration behaves, but the courts have been clear on the First Amendment for decades. In Rankin v. McPherson, 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court said a government employee who joked she hoped Reagan's would-be assassin succeeded could not be fired. In Hustler v. Falwell, 1988, the court unanimously ruled that parody of public figures, no matter how outrageous, is protected. Free speech covers the jokes, the satire, the parodies, even the dumb, crass, or offensive ones. Our constitutional protections exist for this exact moment, for when the government tries to muzzle the people who challenge it. No one has a right to a Netflix special or a network desk. If you cannot build a reliable fan base and they cancel you, that's not censorship. But being suspended because the president's regulator leaned on your bosses, that is the very definition. CBS announced the cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert while the network's owners were awaiting federal approval of its sale. The sale went through. Even with Jimmy back, the lesson's clear. Corporate media will never be our defenders of free speech. That burden falls on us, comics and audiences alike. This is not the time to keep your head down and wait it out. It is time to speak up for your freedom of speech. If you've got truth to tell, find a way to tell it. People look to comedians as truth tellers, and it is our responsibility to show people how to defend not just your voice, but their own. But it only works if we refuse to be silent. The good news? Laughter is what gets us through dark times, and audiences will not let the government steal it. If the First Amendment is going to survive, it will be because we built and defended our own stages, our own platforms, and our own audiences. It will be because the American people will not let our freedoms be taken away. From the brief, New Opioid on the Block by Connor Green, with an E on the end. Amid crackdowns on fentanyl, a potent and less detectable alternative emerges. As efforts to fight the fentanyl trade ramp up, new synthetic opioids that are less detectable and sometimes stronger than the notorious drug are cropping up with great frequency in the American market. Multiple analogs or variations of opioids known as nitazenes have now been detected across more than a dozen states. Some are on par in potency with fentanyl. Others, which are less prevalent but have been detected in the U.S., are exponentially more potent. Their emergence is being seen by scientists who track the spread of opioids around the U.S. as a harbinger of an altered landscape of drugs about which little is known. We are at this really unique inflection point where a lot of the fentanyl supply is contracting, says Navarun Dasgupta, a scientist at the University of North Carolina's Gillings School of Global Public Health, who's been tracking nitazenes and other novel drugs in the U.S. In the coming months, Dasgupta suggests other drugs such as nitazene analogs or other sedatives his lab has detected in the drug supply chain might become more prominent in the market and fill supply gaps left by fentanyl. The sheer volume of fentanyl circulating into and within the country means a major shift in the opioid supply is not immediately imminent, according to experts. But it is possible the apparent increase in nitazenes across the country at the same time fentanyl's presence is waning marks the beginning of such a trend, though it may take years to establish, if it ever does. Dasgupta's lab analyzes drug samples from over 40 states provided by roughly 200 public health agencies, clinics, hospitals, and health departments to provide up-to-date metrics on what drugs are circulating in American markets. It has detected nitazenes in 15 states so far, mostly on the East Coast. But data show the greatest concentration of the drugs in the U.S. is Tennessee, which he describes as a known bellwether for synthetic opioids. Alex Krotulski, Program Manager for New Psychoactive Substance Discovery at the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education's Drug Early Warning System, says he has seen an increasing number of deaths from nitazenes in recent years. Although nitazene-related deaths in Europe have garnered more attention, Krotulski says his research has yielded data indicating a far greater concentration of such deaths in North America. In general, the United States and Canada really bear the majority of nitazene consumption around the world, he says. Krotulski notes the U.S. lacks a uniform way of tracking drugs, and that the absence of this infrastructure suggests the country's numbers are underreported. Dasgupta attributes the emergence of the new drugs being detected in the market in part to enforcement pressure from the U.S. government. Efforts to combat one drug, ultimately leading another to emerge, would not be without precedent. Dasgupta cited the iron law of prohibition, which holds that drug markets begin to favor new products that are easier to trade and potentially more potent when law enforcement on a more common product intensifies. This dynamic was seen roughly 10 years ago when heroin was largely replaced by fentanyl, which now dominates its predecessor in the U.S. market, Dasgupta explains. That transition process happens gradually, however, and the U.S.'s detection infrastructure, as well as the ways nitazenes are moving within the country's drug market, makes it difficult to document. There is no one consistent supply chain across all 50 states, says Sheila Vakaria, who has written on drug use and harm reduction in the U.S. She says regional and urban supply chains interact within their own bubbles across the country, evolving at different rates and slowly introducing new substances into the market. Krotulski notes that while the mixing of nitazenes with other drugs has been documented in low numbers, the fentanyl and nitazene supplies are by no means directly linked. Fentanyl mostly comes to the U.S. through Mexico, while nitazenes are primarily produced in China. They merge and overlap at times, he says, but the two do not directly influence each other because their supply chains, for the most part, operate on their own. It is possible that if fentanyl decreases, nitazenes could increase, but that does not have to necessarily be the case, he tells Time. By all accounts, the increasing and likely underrepresented presence of nitazenes in the U.S. does not come close to rivaling the fentanyl trade at this point. But their emergence is indicative of a market that is undergoing a period of unpredictable shifts and diversification, and that is once again being changed into something new and unknown. Fundamentally, an unregulated drug supply is going to always be changing, Dasgupta says, and we're just at kind of a period of hyperchange that we have never seen before. Also by Connor Green, this half-page article under the title The Bulletin, nearly half of those held by ICE faced no criminal charges. And there's a half-page photograph above the article. The background, is bright red. I mean, it's bright red, like U.S. American flag red. And there is a cadre of people. They are so heavily and fully clothed in khaki attire that looks like it's padded and insulated and everything else. They're wearing helmets. The helmets have visors. They're wearing oxygen masks. They have their arms on one another's shoulders. It looks like they're marching into this redness. The caption reads, law enforcement officers use smoke grenades to disperse demonstrators in front of ICE headquarters in Portland, Oregon, October 4. When President Donald Trump launched his reelection campaign, he vowed to deport the worst of the worst, while blaming migrants for bringing crime, drugs, misery, and death to the U.S. And since he took office for his second term, a wave of public and sometimes violent arrests by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, officers have taken place across the country. The Trump administration has insisted that its hardline immigration agenda is focused on rooting out dangerous criminals to carry out mass deportations as a means of protecting law-abiding Americans. But recent federal data show that more than 70% of detainees held by ICE had no criminal convictions. Nearly half of the 59,762 people in ICE custody, 27,746, had neither a conviction nor pending criminal charges against them, according to the federal data as of September 25. While 17,007 detainees had been convicted of a crime, the remaining 15,009 faced pending criminal charges. Separately, the libertarian Cato Institute reported in June, citing non-public data from the agency, that only 6.9% of detainees had been convicted of violent crimes. The data run counter to the Trump administration's narrative that it has prioritized the worst criminals, as it has deported tens of thousands of people and detained many others. By the end of August, the number of deportations it had carried out was nearing 200,000. The Department of Homeland Security announced last week that 2 million illegal aliens have been removed or have self-deported since Trump's inauguration January 20, saying the administration was on pace to deport nearly 600,000 by year's end. In recent months, Trump has blended the immigration campaign with crime more broadly, notably in Democratic-led cities that have seen protests against ICE. To date, the president has deployed troops to cities, including Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon. The administration has also ramped up immigration enforcement operations in Massachusetts and Chicago, and sought to fight sanctuary city policies that limit local law enforcement's cooperation with federal immigration authorities. In response to a social media post by Trump saying he should be jailed for failing to protect ICE officers, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said he would not back down. What else is left on the path to full-blown authoritarianism? Turning the page to more brief news, good question. How is climate change impacting fall foliage? This is by Simone Shaw, and there's a photo. It's not very large, but it's very colorful. In the background, toward the top, is white and ice blue of a sky. In the nearer background is a blurry image of mountaintops. These are not pointy like the Tetons of Wyoming. These are rounded mountaintops with greenery on top. And on the sides of them, coming down the hills, are more lustrous colors, orange, green, red, yellow. And then even nearer to the foreground, several layers deep from the lens's perspective, more colorful foliage, green, yellow, orange, red, just layer upon layer. And in the very foreground, a reflection of that image, because it's water. And the water, which is blue, is actually reflecting all of the colors behind and beyond it. It is officially fall in the northern hemisphere, but depending on where you are, it might not look like it. From Maine and Vermont to New York, tourists, oh, I forgot to tell you the caption its autumn color at White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire. Okay, now, back to from Maine and Vermont to New York. Tourists often flock to the U.S. East Coast to see the maple and oak leaves transform into vibrant oranges and reds. Leaves can change color from as early as mid-September all the way through early November. But pay closer attention, and you might notice the color shift is not always following that predictable pattern from year to year. Research shows that climate change is already affecting when leaves fall, along with the vibrancy of their colors. A tree that was previously barren by the end of October might still have leaves come November, while a drought-stricken region might see dull brown leaves that simply crumble off the tree. The reason comes down to the biology of foliage. When temperatures drop and the days grow shorter, trees get less sunlight, causing the energy-absorbing chemical chlorophyll, which gives them their green hues, to break down and reveal the other color pigments. They are present the whole time, says Stephanie Spera, a professor at the University of Richmond, who's currently studying shifts in the fall foliage season. They are just masked by all the chlorophyll. Of course, the result looks different depending on the type of tree. Maples and oaks spend their energy creating a sort of sunscreen that helps leaves stay on the branches where they can absorb nutrients a little longer in the fall, and is related to their turning red. Aspens, the most widespread tree in North America, turn a less energy-intensive yellow. Aspen trees and also some other trees get extra nitrogen from fungi in their roots, so they don't need to make such a big effort to recuperate the last nitrogen from their leaf, says Suzanne Renner, honorary professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Related logic is what allows evergreens to skip the whole process. Keeping their leaves is not a drain on their systems. Their needles are really thin and covered in wax, which protects them from the cold, says Spera. The facts of this chemical reaction will not change, no matter how the climate does. The maple trees will continue to be red no matter the temperature, Renner says, because of the underlying chemical ability of the plant to produce this or that color. But trees need cold temperatures to bring out the vibrant hues we are used to seeing. If the leaves in your area are a disappointing brown, it could be the temperatures did not drop low enough to produce bright colors. Fall colors in some regions and some years are pretty dull because the nights were not cold enough, says Renner. Higher temperatures in the summer and autumn can also affect when the leaves begin to fall. Without a stronger decline in temperature, the trees do not have that cue to start shutting down chlorophyll production and shutting down photosynthesis, says Spera. In the region of Maine that Spera has been studying, fall foliage has been delayed by almost a day each decade, mostly because of warmer summer temperatures. Rain and drought can also impact the leaves, with too much rain leading to fungus and too little leading to drought scorch. The leaves literally crisp off the trees, says Spera. Just as each tree has its own chemistry, there is no one-size-fits-all answer to how climate change is affecting this process. Impacts vary depending on the type of tree and the region it lives in. It is not possible to predict across the board how climate warming will impact leaf coloration, says Renner. But the fact that things are changing is already visible in some parts of the U.S. After a summer of drought and erratic rainfall, experts say New England's famous fall foliage, which brings an estimated $8 billion to local economies, will be bright, brief, and early this year. Time off movies. This is the feature, Mining the Origins of a Showbiz Family. by Esther Zuckerman. Ben Stiller did not want to insert himself into his documentary, Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost. The actor and director intended to make a movie about his parents, the revered comedic duo of Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira, and at first felt self-conscious about his own presence. But when he started to show friends the film, which premiered at the New York Film Festival in early October, before it is set to have debuted in theaters October 17 and on Apple TV Plus October 24, he heard a similar refrain, "I'm not really seeing that much of you in it." He realized he had a role to play. The thing that was missing was probably my perspective on my parents, but also my perspective on my own relationships as affected by growing up with them, he said in a phone call while on a break from shooting another family-themed project, the fourth Meet the Parents movie. If he was exposing his parents, he also had to expose himself. It became clear that it would feel weird or disingenuous to open up these private moments that my parents had, and as a filmmaker, not be looking at my own stuff and including that in some way because it felt like I would be judging them. As such, Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost, is a complicated look at generations of Stillers. It functions, perhaps primarily, as a tribute to Jerry and Ann and their legacy. But through the inclusion of intimate recordings that Jerry made, it demonstrates how their comedic bickering on stage was mirrored by genuine tension in prior moments. Meanwhile, Stiller interviews his wife, Christine Taylor, and their children, Ella and Quinn, to understand what he inherited from his famous parents in terms of both his talent and personal shortcomings. I think the deeper that you go into learning about your parents, and not about them as parents, but just as people, it always gives you a different perspective on your own life. I really do feel like the experience of delving in gave me more empathy for them, Stiller says. The backbone of the movie is the wealth of material Jerry left behind when he died in 2020, 5 years after Mira in 2015. On screen, Stiller documents how he and his sister Amy were responsible for combing through family memorabilia as they cleaned up Jerry and Ann's longtime apartment on the Upper West Side so it could be sold. But behind the scenes, Stiller was listening to the more than 100 hours of recordings his father had made. He describes the experience as a strange thing to get transported back into these moments in time. These tapes would start as a record of his and Ann's rehearsal or writing process, but Jerry would leave them running, even when the conversation devolved into real-life arguments, some of which we hear in the film. Stiller at first was surprised to hear those moments of argument, but they also unlocked an angle on his parents' narrative for him. He could chronicle the ups and downs of a creative partnership and how that bled into their personal relationship. From there, he ended up exploring how, despite his own frustration with his parents' absence for periods in his youth, he too became an intense workaholic, like his dad, in ways that resonated with his own children. Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost, offers a standard biodoc look at how a Jewish boy and a Catholic girl fell in love and became the most prominent American couple in comedy in the 1960s. Regulars on the Ed Sullivan Show, Amy and Ben were born into their parents' fame and trotted out for talk show segments at young ages, immediately grandfathered into the act. Along the way, Stiller traces how his mother longed to be a dramatic actress, eventually getting to explore her chops on the stage in plays like The House of Blue Leaves, and how his father had a late-in-life revival, playing George's father, Frank Costanza, on Seinfeld. But the film's also raw and sometimes dark, as the son grapples with Mira's struggles with alcohol, and how this long-time marriage, which lasted over 60 years, was not always so rosy. I had to kind of guess or intuit what my parents might feel about this, knowing them. I think what I got to was this version of the movie that hopefully represented, in terms of the balance of it, what their relationship was always about, which for me was based in this deep love and caring for each other, Stiller says. Making the movie was a 5-year process during which Stiller and Taylor reunited after a period of separation. Ultimately, Taylor, as well as her and Stiller's children, were very open to talking on screen about their sometimes complex feelings about his own dedication to his work at the expense of his time at home. At the same time, Stiller and Mira, Nothing Is Lost, makes the case that show business is, inevitably, a family enterprise. When people see the movie, you can see how organic it was for my sister and I to be part of this world, Stiller says. His sister would also grow up to become an actor, once appearing opposite her mother on King of Queens. It was our reality, and it's what we grew up in, and we loved it when we were kids. The flip side was it took our parents away from us, which any creative endeavor does. You have a creative parent, part of them's going to be dedicated to their creativity if they are a real artist. They cannot deny that. Now, Stiller's own children are feeling that pull to follow in their parents' and grandparents' footsteps. Ella is a Juilliard graduate who's joining the upcoming season of The Comeback following a stint off Broadway. Both young Stillers had roles in Happy Gilmore 2 alongside their dad. Stiller recognizes that the movie enters an ongoing conversation about nepotism in Hollywood, but he hopes it makes viewers understand what it means to come from a world of performers. For me, this really was like, hey, this is what our lives are. This is what it's about, Stiller says. Turning the page to Time Off Movies Review, A Knife's Edge Nuclear Drama by Stephanie Zakarik. Sometimes movies reach us in a place beyond mere assessment. You walk away from the thing you've just seen not really knowing if you would call it good or bad, but you know something has shifted inside you. That is the effect of A House of Dynamite, directed by Kathryn Bigelow, and releasing 15 years after she became the first woman to win the Oscar for Best Director for The Hurt Locker. The picture is precise, potent, ingeniously constructed. But even though it focuses on the nuts and bolts of how the U.S. government might respond to a nuclear attack, there's something ghostly and unreal about it, too. Without spelling out any grim details, it lays bare all sorts of global realities we do not want to think about. This is a real-world horror movie that's unsettling for all that it does not show. The premise is straightforward and sleek. A nuclear missile is headed for the American Midwest, but no one knows which country launched it. If it is not intercepted, it will hit its target in roughly 20 minutes. The film unfolds within that time frame. Its events relayed from multiple points of view, including that of a young major stationed in the Pacific, Anthony Ramos, a deputy advisor who is forced to fill shoes he is not ready for, Gabriel Basso, a Secretary of Defense who can barely reckon with the reality unfolding before him, Jared Harris, and finally the President himself, Idris Elba, who's fairly new to the job when the crisis hits. In Washington, Captain Olivia Walker, Rebecca Ferguson, receives news of the missile launch and responds with concern, but not alarm. The belief at the beginning is that somehow this is a misreading or a mistake. Still, everyone's waiting for the guidance of POTUS, and for several seemingly interminable minutes, his video screen in the Situation Room is a blank square. Where is he? The quiet bustle of the room heightens to a low-level buzz of stress. A cantankerous general, Tracy Letts, Anthony Brady, braces himself for orders. Will the president decide to counterattack? And how will he know what to do when no one knows who is responsible? As the minutes tick by, more urgent calls go out to various specialists and experts, though no one has any clarity on the whole. The movie is divided into sections, each showing this unsettling turn of events from a different character's perspective. Lines of dialogue are repeated from section to section. Sometimes we will see a character saying something we had previously heard only as part of a phone call, and the context shifts slightly. It's all part of a mosaic that changes shape and tone from second to second. A House of Dynamite is one of the most stressful viewing experiences I've had in years. It is a movie with a seemingly endless number of moving parts, cut by Kirk Baxter with diamond precision. In researching it, screenwriter Noah Oppenheim, who was president of NBC News before he began writing for film, interviewed military specialists and others who have spent decades preparing for a catastrophic nuclear event, as the rest of us go about our day-to-day stuff. Ignorance is bliss, but how much of it can we afford? In the years after the U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Americans were haunted by the possibility of nuclear warfare. Our fears showed up in the movies, too. In Cold War dramas like Sidney Lumet's 1964 Fail-Safe. Yet even though the chances of nuclear destruction have hardly receded, we now think about it less. What if you and your community were wiped out in a flash? Or probably worse, left to survive in a scorched, barren world. And if the scenario of a House of Dynamite were to play out in real life, whom would you want at the helm of the government, making potentially world-ending decisions? Bigelow takes the unthinkable and puts it right in front of us. We can ignore the alarm if we want, but that does not mean it is not blasting. Review, two gifted actors, one punishing sci-fi farce by Stephanie Zakaric. The human race is in a sorry state, and here comes Yorgos Lanthimos with an aggressively wicked black comedy to tell us all about it. Haven't you heard? Many of us no longer get our news from the news. We embrace nutty conspiracy theories to justify our own beliefs, and we blindly trust our corporate overlords even as they drain our lifeblood. Not only that, but the bees are dying. These are all good reasons to feel bummed out, but leave it to Lanthimos to express his dismay in the most arch and self-congratulatory way possible. To paraphrase an old Peanuts cartoon, Lanthimos loves mankind. It's people he can't stand. Bugonia, B-U-G-O-N-I-A, begins with a plot and a duo of plotters. Jesse Plemons plays Teddy, a sad-eyed loner with a brain-numbing job and a fondness for bees, which he keeps in the yard of his mildly shabby house. He's a guy who knows the truth about things. He has researched it all on the internet, and he is schooling his sweet, naive cousin Donnie, Aiden Delbus, in his findings. Teddy's a man in pain. He has watched his ailing mother, Alicia Silverstone, suffer through a supposed cure that has in fact put her in a coma. But he has a plan to make things right. Together, Teddy tells Donnie, they will save the world. His plan is to kidnap Emma Stone's Michelle Fuller, the soulless head of a giant techno-corporation that puts profits over people. Teddy believes that Michelle is an alien being from Andromeda sent to Earth to destroy it. Once he and Donnie have her chained up in their basement after first shaving her head, so the Andromedans will not be able to use their fancy technology to locate her via the DNA in her hair, all Teddy has to do is coerce her into summoning her mothership so he can gain entrance and negotiate Earth's freedom with her overlords. Maybe that makes Bugonia a reimagining of Jung Jun Hwan's 2003 science fiction comedy Save the Green Planet. Sounds sort of fun, and the movie does contain some ridiculously over-the-top exploding bodies gore. Plus, Lantimos is working with actors he clearly likes. Plemons and Stone both appeared in his last film, 2024's tedious bummerama, Kinds of Kindness. They are gifted performers who know what they are doing. But in Bugonia, Lantimos lets his poker-faced sadism run free. It's probably supposed to be grimly funny to watch Teddy send 400 volts of electricity coursing through a bound and gagged Michelle after putting on Green Day's basket case cranked up to 11 to drown out her screams. Lantimos and cinematographer Robbie Ryan shoot the sequence discreetly, so you hear more than you see. But do we really want to watch any character played by Stone or by any actor really be brutalized that way? Lantimos is not a filmmaker you can write off entirely. He can surprise you with a movie like The Lobster, which sidles up to some mournful truths about human loneliness with the wayward agility of a hermit crab, or the strange and fanciful Poor Things, also starring Stone, and a grand showcase for her intelligence and physical ingeniousness. She is a bold, creative performer, and she is terrific in Bugonia, laceratingly funny, in cold-blooded executive mode, as she rushes impatiently through the recording of a diversity training video and wholly convincing with her nubbly shaven head as a wily Joan of Arc determined to outwit her captors. Stone gets her true shining moment in the movie's surprise ending, which largely because of her feels tender, mournful, and funny at once, but Lantimos allows us the grace of that ending only after he's put us through the ringer, maybe even boring us a little along the way. The world is not pretty, and Lantimos is shouting the news. If only he would tell us something we don't already know. Time off television. Review, Curb Your Conspiracy Theory, by Judy Berman. This is about the Chair Company, and it airs Sundays on HBO and streams on HBO Max. Ron Trosper is losing it. The HBO comedy The Chair Company traces the unraveling of this suburban family man, played by co-creator Tim Robinson, who believes he stumbled upon a criminal conspiracy following a minor workplace humiliation. But that conspiracy tends to manifest in the form of universal contemporary annoyances. "You can't get a hold of anybody," Ron rants, after his investigation leads him into customer service hell. "That's the problem with the world today. People make garbage, and you cannot talk to anybody. You cannot complain. You cannot get an apology. I want to scream at them." The character will be familiar to anyone who knows Robinson's work. In his Netflix sketch show, I Think You Should Leave, and recent feature, Friendship, the comedian portrays men who are hilariously, uncontrollably angry for reasons they don't seem to fully understand. In his nitpicking and narcissism, the relatability of his grievances, and his unhinged methods of redressing them, Ron also resembles a younger, middle American version of Larry. David's Curb Your Enthusiasm antihero. He's a great character. One portrayed with the explosive mix of awkwardness and rage Robinson has perfected, and placed in situations that are funny because they're absurd, but also because, despite their surreal trappings, they speak to modern discontents. It is all just entertaining enough to make up for the show's scattershot storytelling. Ron is at once an average guy and a mess of insecurities. At home, he's overshadowed by an impressive wife, Lake Bell, and teenage son, Will Price, as well as his daughters, Sophia Lillis, upcoming wedding. She and her wife-to-be want to marry in a haunted barn. Now that his dream business venture has failed, he's returned to a stressful job at a construction company. All it takes is one blip to send him down the rabbit hole. Sometimes his quest for the truth takes the shape of a prototypical thriller, rendezvous at dive bars, threats issued by shadowy goons in parking lots. Other times Ron is a terminally online Larry, typing screeds into customer support forms and cursing out chatbots. Robinson's style of comedy may not be best suited to long-form narrative. Writer-director Andrew D. Young's Friendship, which cast him as a lonely guy who befriends, alienates, then becomes fixated on a cool neighbor, Paul Rudd, has some great moments, but falters midway through because of a predictable plot. In the 6 Chair Company episodes I screened out of 8, Robinson and co-creator Zach Kanin do not make the conspiracy thriller funny so much as they use its tropes to connect characters and situations that are, in themselves, very funny. Robinson has a genius for channeling society's ambient, toxic vibes in abstract but eerily evocative ways through his odd alter egos. Friendship is a funhouse mirror of the male loneliness crisis. Yet his sensibility is most potent in the concise scenarios of I Think You Should Leave, from the guy who will not stop making filthy comments on an adult ghost tour, to the one in the hot dog costume who insists he had nothing to do with the crash of a hot dog-shaped car. These characters embody the anger, mendacity, immaturity, and allergy to accountability that define so many of today's most powerful men without explicitly addressing politics. The Chair Company's hero is the other side of that coin, a disempowered man whose earnestness brings him only embarrassment, and whose attempts to find someone to blame for his misery only dig him deeper into it. Ron's crusade against corporate shadiness and shoddiness never generates much suspense. But whether he strikes you as an everyman Larry David or as a modern-day David taking on a faceless Goliath, his plight is bound to resonate. Time has included a list of nifty inventions. I will read a couple of those to you. Consumer electronics, a TV breakthrough, Samsung Micro RGB. This is by Chris Stokel Walker. Most premium TVs still rely on a single large white or blue backlight filtered through color layers, a setup that can mute vibrancy and waste energy. Samsung's micro RGB TV instead uses individually controlled red, green, and blue LEDs tens of microns wide, giving richer, more lifelike colors, and cutting power use by 20%. Micro-RGB is a breakthrough in premium TV technology, says Tae Young Son, EVP of Samsung's visual display business. The first micro-RGB TVs ship this year for $29,999 each. Samsung's glare-free glass and an onboard AI engine further refine each scene's crispness and color. Sports and fitness, a better baseball bat. Louisville slugger Pro Prime TPD1 by Sean Gregory. A long ball barrage has sparked a craze. The New York Yankees hit a record-tying 15 home runs in their first three games of the 2025 season. Some players used Louisville slugger's odd-looking Torpedo Prime bats, which move the fat sweet spot closer to the handle, where players are more likely to strike the ball. Now, wood bat sales for the maker of Louisville sluggers are up some 20% year after year. Really good players have had fantastic success with it, says VP of Manufacturing Bobby Hillerick. It's proof in performance. Former Yankees analyst Aaron Leinhart, an MIT-trained physicist, is credited with inventing it. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.